Turning, please, to Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 30. Luke 22:24-30. And as some of you will note, this is exactly what we did Wednesday night, but we got no recording on either machine. And people want to know where is the hole in Luke. So we'll go over exactly the same lesson that we did in Wednesday evening. Two things are involved in this little section. Remember, we're in the upper room. We're looking at the last 24 hours of the life of Jesus on earth. And in that upper room, a dispute breaks out. And it's the subject of verses 24 through 34. And so we start then with the occasion. The occasion is stated in verse 24. Keep in mind, we're in the upper room. Passover meal has been eaten. The Lord is... several things took place that we ought to pull together. Passover meal has been eaten. The Lord's Supper has been instituted. Judas has been pointed out, and Judas has now left the room. He's on his way out to meet the Jewish officials and others in order to effect the betrayal of Jesus that will take place in just a few minutes. Literally, just a few minutes from this incident. Everybody's been fairly self-centered among the disciples. They all sat down at the table. The traditional washing of feet, nobody did. So in the middle of the meal, the Lord rises and he does it. And it's into this setting now, within hours of the cross, that we have the following words in verse 24. And there arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was regarded to be the greatest. And so the first thing to ask then is, why did the dispute over greatness arise at this point? Remember, they are at a meal. And if there was any one single place that who was the greatest was recognized, it was at a meal. Because as you recall, we have drawn previously the way the table was set up in the middle. And there was seating at the end. And right in the middle was the host. And to his right and left was the number one and the number two position of honor. That would move down to the seating along the side of the table. And each one of those was assigned a number. And the number indicated honor and greatness. And therefore you would have something like maybe three down the side or more. And then you'd have three on the end, with the end table next to the host being the number one and two places of honor. Remember, a few weeks ago, Jesus had come in and he had watched people seating themselves, among them being the disciples, had watched them seat themselves at the table and how they scrambled and pushed one another to get the place of honor. And he had a little discourse on doing that. But at this point, they have now set up in the upper room. The upper room would not be empty. It would have a table. It would have seating. It would have places for to set the water pitcher, tables for those. And at this point, a dispute rises. Who's greater? And you can easily see how it would happen. That Peter, for example, may have lunged for the first place, and John said, "Get out of the first place. I belong in the first place." And another disciple may have said, "I'll take number two spot of honor. That's mine. I deserve it." And they would have all kinds of argumentation as to why I should be number one guest. And I can tell you why I should be on this side. And they were all fighting for the upper level seats. Isn't that great dignity? The evening on which the Lord is going to die. And it puts in such complete contrast self-centeredness with self-sacrifice that was practiced on his part. Just a couple of incidents like this to show how often this happened among the disciples. Go back to Luke chapter 9. Luke 9. This wasn't unusual. This was a very common problem they had as to who was deserving of the honorable seats. Luke 9:46. And an argument arose among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child, stood him by his side, and said to them, and he makes a lesson out of, you must be like this little child, and gives them this lesson in chapter 9 and verse 48. But notice the setting is a dispute over who's great. Same book, chapter 14. 14 and 7. And in verse 7, certainly among the people that the Lord observed were the disciples. He began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they'd been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, and he builds a parable on it. If you go to John chapter 13, John 13, and in the midst of the Passover meal, notice that a menial servant's job had not been done. And so you come to chapter 13 and verse 6. Well, we really need to go back to verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things to his hands, they're now seated at the Passover table, into his hands, and that he'd come forth from God and was going back to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, taking a towel, girded himself about, poured water in a basin, began to wash the disciples' feet and wipe them with the towel with which he is girded. And then, of course, comes a sudden rush of humility on the part of Peter, because Peter says to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And then Peter throws his little tantrum and says, you're not going to wash my feet because you're greater than I am. But you see the context of the whole thing? All right, one question I had on it, and let's go back to the Luke passage. Have you ever been really in a situation like this? I have not. Have you ever been to a dinner where everybody rushed for the host and hostess's chair and a big fight broke out over, I'm better than you are, I'm greater than you? How do we approach that? We don't do things like this, do we? I've never been in a context where this has happened. Therefore, what are we going to conclude? The attitude of thinking one is greater than the other doesn't exist anymore. Is that a good answer? Is it possible that we just do it better and more refined? That's probably it, isn't it? We know how not to deal with the attitude, probably do the same thing, except, well, now you might think, when you've been out to dinner, do we ever, with someone's house, do we ever make comments about how so-and-so acted or what their attitude was or how proud? Maybe so. But nonetheless, it's probably just that we have learned, you never see this scene scrambling for plate. You never see that in a dining room. But again, men have not changed, so it's probably we've just refined the attitude and become somewhat better hypocrites than they used to be. So let's be sure to take a good lesson from it. And this is probably what happened. We might notice also, and maybe we should have put this in observations, but let's not. Notice on this occasion how a wrong attitude, and they certainly had that, a wrong attitude can spoil the most holy setting. Holy attitude can spoil a holy setting. And I don't mean holy setting in a pretentious way. But it is just that, is it not? It is the Passover time, a special season. It is the Lord saying to the disciples, this is the last one that while I will ever eat with you until I see you again in the kingdom. And therefore, it's a very solemn, special, holy atmosphere. Which provides the setting. And it's within hours that the Lord will suffer like no one has ever suffered. It's within minutes literally minutes that he will be in the Garden of Gethsemane and will experience the greatest agony. And so you have a great contrast of self-sacrifice side by side with self-centeredness in this particular event that comes at this point. Well, on that occasion, the Lord begins to give his instruction. And his instruction builds about a theme. But before we put up the theme, let's indicate that there are going to be two themes. So the theme is going to be one of contrast, taking the text and looking at verse 25 through 30. And the first thing to note is that verse 24 and 25, or 25, yes, 24, 25, is in total contrast to everything else. So what we're going to have is verse 24, 25 over here on our left, and 26 through 30 over here on the right. And the theme will be total contrast. So let's read it, verse 25. Really, only 2 points. He said to them, verse 25, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors, but not so with you. But let you who is the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as the servant. And that continues down through verse 30. So really, there are only 2 themes that are established in that context. And if mentally you want to see the way they're set up in the text, go to verse 26, take the word you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th word over, the pronoun you. And we can say 2 things about it. Number one, by form, that is the way it's spelled, it's emphatic. But not only is it emphatic by form, but if you would put that word where it belongs in the sentence, you would take the pronoun you and put it right over in place of the word but. And therefore shows, by first in sentence, underline it, boldface it, underscore it. And therefore verse 26 says, you, not so. In other words, this attitude that's found in verse 25 should not be the attitude of you. So, the theme of verse 25 is this. Egotism is a trait of paganism. Egotism is a trait of paganism. And as soon as he states that in verse 25, he will immediately turn and say, this is not to be true of you. Second theme. And then it is introduced, which comes in and contrasts the egotism with humility. Humility is a trait of Christianity. So there are the 2 points then. Number one, egotism is a trait of paganism. And he will point out 2 things that you know about your pagan leaders. Number one, you know that they practice ruthless rule. They practice ruthless rule. 25A. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. And the word lord it is meant to reek with egotism. It does not simply say the kings of the Gentiles rule. It doesn't say the kings of the Gentiles administer. They lord it. And lord it simply is pointing to a word of despotism. They rule in a despotic way. But second, they do something else. They also practice hypocritical, second part of the verse, hypocritical righteousness. Because they love titles, and the one that they love most of all is translated benefactors. They lord it, and yet they are benefactors. Isn't that usually true in the political scene? You will have a bureaucrat or a politician who will literally lord it over the people that he's supposed to administer. And then about campaign time comes on as what? Your great benefactor. I'm the one you need. And you see that in all levels where authority is involved, that the authority is exercised in a ruthless way, and yet the picture is supposed to be, it is certainly all for your good. And we do have in mind your self-interest. Now I'm going to take time to write out the word translated benefactor. It is the Greek word euergetes. And the reason for writing out that word for you is because that exact word was used by many of your leaders. For example, on a denarius coin, Augustus was called God. And I put that in quote because God is on the coin. That obviously involves rulership. It also involves being a benefactor or a good person. So Augustus said, you simply think of me as God. And he certainly exercised the strongest rule. Tiberius Caesar has a phrase, one who deserved to be adored. One who deserved to be adored. Keep in mind that, and you probably already picked it up, in the Greek-Roman world time of the New Testament, egos were rampant. And there was nothing considered to be inappropriate about your arguing your high status. And as you can see here, even though we may have lots of egotism among politicians, I don't really think you'd have one whose campaign sign would say, da-da, one who deserves to be adored. That's a little bit strong for our culture, and I certainly don't think that anyone running for the presidency would put under their name God. Only Rush Limbaugh would do that. So nonetheless, in the context, there was all kinds of ego that was involved, and let me add to this word, there were two great rulers in Egypt, Ptolemy I and II, two different people. And they applied this word exactly to their position. That's who they said they were. Euergetes. And they used the word of themselves. So it's very probable that when Jesus is looking about, he sees that word. It's also used of some lesser officials. But apparently enough that Jesus said, I notice how many people out there, pagan in character, full of ego, ruling and lorded over you, love to put that word next to their name. And that is the point, and the disciples doubtless identified with it. And his whole point is egotism is a trait of paganism. But you, and I write those letters large and underscore you repeatedly, because both by form in Greek and by position in the sentence, it's the word that says you are to be different. And that then introduces the second theme, or the contrasting theme, and it is this. Contrasting with egotism is humility. Humility is a trait of Christianity. And that now becomes the theme in 26 through 30. And that has two parts to it, really. The first is the up is down doctrine, which says we must begin as servants, if ever to become kings. We must begin as servants. And since we encounter it so often, I'll put in parentheses, this is the up is down teaching of Scripture. The up is down teaching of the Bible. And that is so inflexibly true that the same principle applies even to the Son of God, who was God, who was King, who was Lord in the fullest sense of the word, but even being in that position, up is down, even applied to Him. And therefore, the suffering went before the crown, the cross went before the glory, and this applied across the board. So there are no exceptions to this. We must begin as servants or servant attitude, and then from that point we can go up. Now, when you read verse 26, and some of you that were here Wednesday will already see this, but when you read verse 26, what is there that you wouldn't expect? Just the way it's worded is unusual and strange. But not so with you, but let him who is the greatest, and you would think, what is the antonym for greatest? Least. Who among you who is greatest among you become as the youngest? And you would expect that it would read, let him who is greatest among you become the least among you. But the contrast is not greatest least. The contrast is greatest youngest. Now, why would that be the contrast? Important to note is that greatest youngest is the contrast that he works on. And that has to be explained because that doesn't fit our 20th century reasoning. We don't think that way, and therefore need to ask why and give reasons for it. In the Bible, let's just put biblical mentality, because many, many times we come to the Bible and read it with Western mentality, and that doesn't work. As a matter of fact, you can read the Bible 15 hours a day with Western mentality and miss the whole point. So you have to come with it, not with our Western mentality, with a biblical mentality, the way they thought. And biblical mentality at this point is very simple. Age is honorable. And therefore, to be respected in every way. Now, I think it's especially hard for us if we were teaching this, let's say, in an Oriental context. We probably wouldn't have to be so forceful. Because in Oriental context, age is honorable. And it's respected and it's responded to because the thought is, with the passage of years, you've learned something. And that's a reasonable expectation out of life, is it not? That as you pass years, you ought to learn something. Unfortunately, that's we have to say you ought to. But nonetheless, that makes sense, that you've had experience with life, you've faced life, you're a little bit older, and therefore you understand a few more things, you've got better insight, you've got a better perspective on life because you've experienced it a little bit, and therefore you ought to know what you're talking about. We don't think that way, do we? Every once in a while, frankly, it infuriates me. It gets in the paper. There's a great issue in the world, and some reporter goes and interviews a junior high social studies class. You think, what in the world would they have to contribute? Nothing wrong with being junior high. It's just that you don't know anything yet. And I don't say that disrespectfully. How could you? You haven't been around enough years to know something. And that's not ridicule in any sense of the world. It's just to say, if you're young, you're wonderful, you're beautiful, you're nice, we love you, but you're stupid. And I'm not calling names. I'm just saying, look at the mechanics. 12 years, 50 years, ought to be a difference. The only thing that is worse in this whole context, isn't it pitiful to be 50 and as stupid as you were at 12? And that's the despicable thing. It's not despicable to be 12. It's despicable to be 50 going on 12. But at any rate, age is honorable, and let's run through a few passages. Leviticus 19. You know, having a respect for age, again, is not a matter of someone being better than. It's just real simple. Here's a road that looks paved so beautifully, and you've been down it. And you know that about 5 miles down that road, it's washed out. I mean, you have to turn around and come back. You know that because you've been down the road. And here's someone else that's about to take that road. And you share with them, you know, I really wouldn't go down that road. It looks so beautiful. It's so well paved. But about 5 miles down there, it's washed out. Now, what would the typical response to be? Well, who are you? You don't know anything about it. And very stupid. And if you're younger, don't hurt yourself by refusing to listen. And matter of fact, seek it out. Ask somebody that's been down that road. And see if there's any rough spots, any potholes down that road. They can probably tell you about it, and that doesn't make them any better. It just means they've had a little experience. They can show you about potholes, some things that you really don't know, and that's not demeaning to you. All it says about you is what? You're smart. Any young person that has the sense to seek out the advice of maturity and age is smart. And should be respected for that type of attitude, and it's important, but it's hard to do, isn't it? I didn't. Did you? Did you seek out the wisdom of maturity about some of the roads that you've pursued in life? Probably not. That is what God gave us parents for, but let's get back to the text. Leviticus 19:2. Notice this was not a matter of 1932, not a matter of notice this is a matter of law in Israel. You shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged, and you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. So notice in Israel the respect for, and again, the gray-headed, the aged, are simply, the gray-headed certainly is a metaphor expressing age and a picture of age, the most typical thing that you have with age. Or if you prefer it, maybe you'll want to say, rise up before those with crow's feet and that sort of thing. Because whatever conveys to you the idea of age is, that does it not put a great responsibility on age and youth both. We're to be mutually beneficial to one another. The experience of age is to be shared. And on the other hand, those are to seek that fountain, hopefully, of wisdom that is there. And it's commanded in the law. Job 32. It's another section that gives a narrative of the same event. Job 32, verse 4. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job. And from the context, we'll find out that Job was lots older than Elihu. Elihu, the younger, had waited to speak with Job, the older, because they were years older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of the three men, his anger burned. So Elihu and the son of Barachel, the Buzite, spoke out and said, I am young in years, and you are old. Therefore, I was shy and afraid to tell you what I think. I thought age should speak and increased years should teach wisdom. So again, interesting narrative with that. Proverbs 16. Proverbs 16. There's a lot of aligning of our minds to do on this, is there not? I had Shoney's up on old salad bar a while back, and the girl comes with the bell and she says, "Are you a senior?" I guess we can't even say the whole thing. Senior citizen. But it was, "Are you a senior?" I said, "You mean old?" And she just collapsed. Sure, that's what it means. Older. What's wrong with older? What's wrong with age? So Proverbs 16:31. I won't go back to Shoney's, but that has nothing to do with it. Verse 31, a gray head is a crown of glory, something to be pleased with. In it is found the way of righteousness. And again, that's assuming that the experiences of life have been met and responded to properly. 2029, same book. 2029. Don't ever forget this. Every phase of life has its compensations. Every phase has its disadvantages. Every phase has its compensations. And there's certain things that you get compensated with when you're young, but you don't have something else. When you get to your 20s, there's something you have then, but there's something else you don't have. Get into your 30s, there's something nice that you can only have in your 30s, and you couldn't have in your teens, but there are also some disadvantages beginning to creep in. You don't run as fast and do certain things as you used to. And all up and down the line, God has built in a beautiful balance to life. Grandchildren, you can't have those in your teen years. Well, in most cases, you can't have grandchildren in your teen years. But that's nice. That's nice that you do come to the point in life where, and it just seems as though God has said, okay, you've got arthritis, but I'll bless you with this. And later on, something else is falling apart, and God says, well, let me give you this little compensation, something you couldn't have back in your youth that you can have now. And it's really very beautiful if you can approach life from the standpoint of noticing the compensations that all come along and come along with age. And in many cases, the value of those compensations is dependent upon the decisions you made way back here. Never forget, the quality of age is determined by the decisions of youth. And that is true over and over. And that's why from youth you begin making good decisions. And you make those good decisions. And if you may be midway through life and you've made some terrible decisions, start making some good ones. They'll probably pay off about 10 years down the line, 15 years, 20 years down the line, and they will be there. And that's the importance of decision, of taking in the Word, of gaining wisdom and knowledge and understanding. And I don't say this in a derogatory manner, but isn't it pitiful to see old people in the store who really, in terms of being meaningful to anybody, might as well be dead? Isn't that pitiful? Breathe your last and leave nothing of wisdom, of helpfulness, and so forth. And that's very, very, very pitiful. Actually, we should become more useful the older we get. Okay, let's go back now then to Luke. And hopefully we can now approach it with a biblical mentality. Let him, verse 26, who is the greatest among you become as the youngest. Looking at it from the biblical standpoint, willing to learn, able to learn, anxious to learn, offering respect to the older or the greater. And that is the context in which Jesus is teaching. Now, it does say something else then. And that is this. To be Christ-like, and he's going to tie this directly in by saying he is the servant. To be Christ-like, we must defy. We must defy traditional views of greatness. To be Christ-like, we must defy traditional views of greatness. In other words, our norms and standards for greatness that we have learned from our environment must go. Has to be a totally opposite thing. Can I put it another way? Traditional greatness is not Christ-like greatness. Repeat. Traditional greatness, as we know it, is not Christ-like greatness. Now, notice, again, coming through the context. Verse 26. Not so with you. Egotism is not the center of life. But let him who is the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as the servant. But who is greater? Rhetorical question now. Who is greater? The one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? And answer that from the standpoint of traditional view of greatness. And what's the answer? Well, Jesus answers it with the traditional view and says, is it not the one who reclines at the table? Who is the person of honor? The person that brings the meal to you and serves you well at the table? That is the servant traditionally, and the person at the table is great. And then the last sentence of verse 27 had to hit them like a load of bricks. But I, the Son of God, without sin, ruler of the universe, am among you as the one who serves. And you can't think of a greater up is down than you have in John 13, when the Lord himself washes Peter's and John's and Andrew's feet. It's the biggest up is down illustration anywhere, because it is literally the God of the universe washing human feet. And God says, that's the way you go up. So, we must begin as servants. We then can be kings. Those are two contrasting words in the context. And the Lord, again, points out to them. And let's go back and read it and then complete it. Verse 28. And verse 28 has a little something in it that we'll want to pick up on next hour. But notice before we move to the second part, he makes a comment about them. He says, you are those who have stood by me in my trials. We'll come back to that next hour. And just as my Father has granted me a kingdom, I grant you that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And so notice, the way down was up. We must begin as servants, and then we can become kings. We can lead when we learn to be led. We can give orders when we learn to take orders. Father, we're thankful today for your word in Christ's name. Amen.